From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, Massachusetts Senator Ed Markey files legislation that would require the president to seek congressional approval for a first-strike nuclear attack. We'll also hear Secretary of State Bill Galvin's reaction to Trump's call for a voter fraud investigation.
Either put up or shut up.
Also today, how private is your medical record?
Today, there's dossiers, sort of extended patient histories on 530 million people worldwide.
How big medical data is creating a multi-billion dollar industry without your knowledge because it doesn't even need your consent. Plus,
I think you should be the friend in Friend with Benefits. That part comes first. Sometimes friends say to friends, like, dude, you gotta know that when you do X, blank happens.
Sex advice columnist Dan Savage is in town and he'll take your questions next on Radio Boston.
Friends, how many of us have them?
First, this news.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. President Donald Trump signed several executive orders today, including one to begin ramping up construction of the border wall that was the signature proposal of his presidential campaign. He also signed directives to hire thousands of new Border Patrol officers, to create more detention centers, and to withhold federal funds for sanctuary cities. Trump spoke at the Department of Homeland Security saying, quote, beginning today, the United States gets control of its borders. Well, let's get some reaction from one of Massachusetts' top officials, Senator Ed Markey. He joins us today from Shepherdstown, West Virginia. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me on.
So first of all, Senator, I mean, you heard some of what the president had to say about the executive orders he signed. What's your reaction? He's fulfilling several promises he made on the campaign trail.
Well, I think that obviously he's fulfilling his campaign pledges, but to what effect? He's going to build a border wall, detain families and children at our border, and turn back asylum seekers. And what he's also going to do is trigger a whole spate of raids, mass deportations, fear and terror within our immigrant communities. I don't think these policies are going to make America great or safer. They will isolate us and undermine our standing in the world. So I think there's a part of Lady Liberty right now that is shedding a tear at Donald Trump's executive actions.
You know, on the other hand, the president said that, these are his words, he said, we're going, with these executive orders, he believes we're going to save thousands of lives. He said, when it comes to public safety, quote, there is no place for politics, no Republicans, no Democrats, just citizens. And we want safe communities and we demand safe communities for everyone. I mean, and in President Trump's mind, that everyone includes, as he, you know, took pains to point out, family members of victims who were attacked and sometimes even killed by undocumented immigrants.
Well, obviously, we support a policy of deporting those who have engaged in criminal activities. The problem with what the president just said is that he didn't say what he's going to do with young people, for example, who were brought here as children, as infants, who have gone through our school system in Massachusetts, who are honors graduates of our universities, but who now are wondering, are they about to be deported? Are people about to knock on their door? The president did not distinguish between those who have engaged in serious criminal activity, who, of course, must be deported, and the millions and millions of people who are here, who are now fearful that their peaceful lives, their productive lives, are now going to be put in jeopardy.
Now, Senator, what do you make of the fact that also today President Trump did sign an executive order, in his words, cracking down on sanctuary cities? There are several of those cities here in Massachusetts. They do stand to lose some funding for their decisions to be sanctuary cities. Are you concerned about that?
I am concerned about it. The mayors of Somerville, the mayor of Cambridge, they believe that they can make their cities safer by having better cooperation between the police and the immigrant communities, that they don't live in fear of the police acting in an arbitrary way. And I defer to those mayors. They know their cities best. And so, yes, it's going to be a very punitive action, which President Trump undertakes if he tries to coerce cities that are acting in their community's best interest to engage in activities which they believe are actually counterproductively going to increase the crime rate, increase the isolation of the immigrant community from the law enforcement officials with whom today they do not have to fear.
Hmm. Now, Senator Markey, you're speaking to us today from Shepherdstown, West Virginia, where Senate Democrats are holding a retreat. I mean, what is the discussion there amongst your fellow Democrats in the Senate about what, if anything, as a party, or at least in the Senate that can be done, if you think it's necessary to block or counteract, we can't block them, but to counteract these executive orders, which will come, fast and furious in the next several days and weeks?
Yeah, what we're doing down here at our retreat is trying to put together a core set of messages, which we will be delivering to the American people. And it will be something that has a unified voice on the protection of the Affordable Care Act in terms of how it affects ordinary families in our country, how they are our neighbors, they're our friends, they're our co-workers. These are people who are going to lose benefits. And the same thing is true for education. The same thing is true for other issues. We're putting together a set of messages which we think are going to work in countering Donald Trump's attacks on all of the achievements of the Democratic Party on Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, education, health care over the years. And we are ready to fight while simultaneously saying we are willing to work with the president if he wishes to negotiate. But that is not Donald Trump.
So far
has just declared war on each and every one of these policies.
So, Senator, just if I may, so you're right now working on messaging, essentially, as you said, but what about actual concrete actions? No doubt the messaging is important, but surely are there bills, proposals, amendments, specific things that Senate Democrats plan to do?
Yes, of course. And that includes a comprehensive infrastructure transportation bill, roads, bridges, rural broadband, a comprehensive package of infrastructure improvements across the country that can put millions of Americans back to work. And that's the kind of an area where we have a chance potentially to work with Donald Trump in a constructive way. But again, it's going to ultimately be up to President Trump if he wishes to work in a cooperative fashion with Democrats on issues like that. Thus far, on the environment, on health care, he has just declared war against the environmental laws, the health care laws that the Democrats have put on the books to defend the public health, to defend the clean air, the clean water of our country.
I wanted to ask you, speaking of proposals and legislation, just yesterday, you and Republican Congressman Ted Lieu of California introduced legislation that would strip the president's ability to conduct a first-use nuclear strike without the declaration of war or a declaration from Congress. Now, why did you feel compelled to introduce this legislation?
Well, I feel compelled to do it because Donald Trump has already said that he would welcome a nuclear arms race with Russia. He supported additional countries acquiring nuclear weapons like Japan, South Korea, and Saudi Arabia. And he has said that he would consider launching nuclear attacks against terrorists. And that is a profoundly dangerous proposal. Donald Trump just doesn't understand that nuclear arms race and how it can spin out of control. His policies will make the world more unsafe and not safer. So the sole purpose of nuclear weapons is to deter other nuclear weapons. No United States president should ever use a nuclear weapon or even consider the use of it unless there is a nuclear attack threatened from the other country that we fear could use the weapon itself. But
now,
in a conventional weapon situation, it should never be used.
Now, granted, when he was a candidate, Donald Trump was kind of all over the map in terms of what he said about nuclear weapons. But he did say in the first debate that was moderated by Lester Holt, he said that he would not do a first strike. Two sentences later, he said, at the same time, we have to be prepared. I can't take anything off the table. So some inconsistencies there. But Senator Markey, let me ask you, he's the president and commander in chief. This proposal would essentially make a profound change to the options that any president should or would have as commander in chief. Isn't that a major change that perhaps isn't warranted no matter who's president?
No, I do not think so. And as you just said, he basically said that he doesn't want to take the first use of nuclear weapons off the table. So you're right, he contradicted himself, but ultimately the latter part of that sentence reflects the rest of his nuclear use philosophy. And we, as Congress, have a responsibility to ensure that we put the parameters around the use of these weapons. In the Constitution, it is the Congress and not the president who determines when a war is begun. And this would be a nuclear war begun by the United States of America. And we should not allow President Trump or any president to use nuclear weapons except in response to a nuclear attack against the United States.
Well, Senator Markey, we're out of time with you now, but I hope to have you back really soon to talk about the FCC, Keystone XL, lots of other stuff. We hope you can join us again sometime soon.
Thank you for having me on.
That's Massachusetts Senator Ed Markey. He spoke with us today from Shepherdstown, West Virginia. Well, one more note about actions or things that President Donald Trump said today. It's been a busy day for him because this morning President Trump reiterated his false claim, one for which there is absolutely no proof, that there was widespread voter fraud in the election that he won. And he ratcheted up that claim this morning by tweeting, quote, "I will ask for a major investigation into voter fraud, including those registered to vote in two states, those who are illegal, and even those registered to vote who are dead," in parentheses he added, "and many for a long time. Depending on the results, we will strengthen up voting procedures." Well, the top official who runs elections here in Massachusetts is reacting strongly to the president's call for an investigation. Here's Massachusetts Secretary of State Bill Galvin. He spoke to WBUR earlier today.
To suggest that dead people vote is not true. We purge all the dead off the list here. To make lies about voters like that is a disservice to our citizens. And I mean, this is clearly a case where we have to call it the emperor has no clothes. He has no facts and no clothes. I just find it disgusting that somebody who is the president of the United States would continue to say things that are so outrageous and untrue. Either put up or shut up. But it's not right to be suggesting that people who are legitimate citizens, who voted, who exercised their right to vote, who just didn't happen to vote for him, somehow were criminals or illegal or improper, because they weren't. If he really thinks the election was rigged to that extent, well, why don't we do it again? See if he wins. I don't think he will. So we're certainly not going to let him just throw mud on the citizens of Massachusetts.
That's Massachusetts Secretary of State Bill Galvin. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. If there's one place that people still expect a reasonable amount of privacy, it's the doctor's office. But according to journalist Adam Tanner, maybe they should not. In the world of Google and big data, he explains that every drug you're prescribed, every blood test, every step on that scale, It's all recorded. And that data has created a multi-billion dollar business, one where your most intimate data is aggregated and then sold to companies that have nothing to do with your treatment. Tanner explains how this happens in his new book, Our Bodies, Our Data, how companies make billions selling our medical records. He's also a writer in residence at the Institute for Quantitative Social Science at Harvard, but he joins us today from the studios of KUAC in Fairbanks, Alaska. Adam Tanner, welcome to Radio Boston.
Hello.
It's great to have you. So first of all, how is it possible that any data gets collected and used without our knowledge? Because I thought we had a Healthcare Privacy Act.
So data that removes your name and certain key identifiers about you is allowed to be sold and gathered into dossiers about you. So you go into the doctor's office, you close the door, you tell the doctor your intimate problems. The doctor sends you to the pharmacist. He sends you to a blood test. All of this is recorded in insurance claims. All of those things can be commercially sold if your name is removed. Now, the issue here is if there's years of information about you held by a commercial data gatherer of some kind, that it may be possible to re-identify you and possibly use that information against you. So interestingly, this trade has developed in dramatic ways in recent years, but patients don't know about it, and often doctors do not know about it, or pharmacists or people administering the blood tests, all those healthcare providers we meet in this system.
Okay, so you said it may be possible to re-identify you, but I thought that the records were supposed to be effectively stripped of identifying information, right?
So the information in the record still has your date of birth, your section of town that you live in, your doctor's name is included in there, your gender. So if you had years of information about someone, you would be able to recognize them perhaps from the file. So take me as an example. I'm teaching for a year in Fairbanks, Alaska. Before that, I was in the Cambridge area. Before that, I was in Belgrade, Serbia. I may be the only person of my age to have been in those three places over those years. So if you just had that basic information, you would be able to pick me out from the file. Thanks to the cheap storage and amazing computing, you can find the needle in the haystack.
Well, we'll talk about who's aggregating and selling this information in a second, but who's buying it?
So typically this is used to promote the sale and marketing of drugs. So the biggest buyer of this all will be the big drug companies.
And they use it for?
So they create several different kinds of profiles. There are doctor-identified profiles. They know that your doctor typically prescribes a certain drug, drug A, for example. And if you work for drug company B, you may want to send a representative to tell them how great drug company B is and their offerings. So they specifically know and can specifically target doctors based on the prescribing patterns. For patients, there's several different kinds of data that's gathered about you. There's this anonymized data. There's also identified data about you that's collected outside of the doctor's office, things that you do that are not covered by HIPAA, the rules on medical data, things you do on the internet, products that you buy, things you say on social media, your fitness devices that you wear, trackers, things like that. All of that data can be openly sold with your name. And then that allows marketing companies to figure out what types of patients may be most likely to suffer certain ailments. So it's all about sales and marketing, but it's often intrusive in a way that you may not expect.
Now, you spoke with pharmacy chains about selling patient data. Who did you speak with and what did they tell you?
Companies who sell data are typically quite reluctant to talk about this in great detail. It's very lucrative for most of the players on the chain, with the exclusion of the patients who do not benefit in any way from this. But I've talked to, building this history over the past 50 years, how this industry developed, I've talked to hundreds of different officials, past and present, who confirm this trade is taking place. For a company such as CVS or a big drug company, they make tens of millions of dollars a year. That's not a huge amount for such a huge company, but it is a percentage extra onto their bottom line profits. It's worth taking. They'd rather not discuss these kind of things in great detail typically, They'd rather keep quiet. And they are fully abiding by the law, which allows this trade.
Right. So that's the interesting thing, because your book focuses on one health information data mining company in particular. It's called IMS. Now, tell us a bit about them. They started back in the 1950s, right? But they weren't necessarily, I mean, in the 1950s, there wasn't really any data mining, healthcare data mining business to speak of. But how did this company become what it is today?
So IMS Health, which has recently renamed itself to Quintiles IMS, got its start in the 1950s. It was started by a German immigrant to New York City who headed one of the biggest medical advertising firms. There was a big boom in medical advertising. He was quite a secretive person, and he was in a secret alliance with his biggest rival, Arthur Sackler, a name that may be familiar to Boston area listeners because of the Sackler collection at the museum at Harvard. Mm-hmm. The two of them together secretly formed this company, IMS Health, which initially is just measuring what drugs are selling well in different markets. They start in Germany, they expand in Europe and come to the United States. Over time, though, in more recent years, long after the Froelich and Sackler are dead, they start gathering this information about individual patients. And so in recent years, they've been able to build these dossiers. They have more than 500 million dossiers about individual patients worldwide. Their dossiers are anonymized, but as I say, they contain a lot of intimate personal information.
Yeah. So we actually have a clip here from one of IMS Health's promotional videos. We should say this is one that they've posted on YouTube. And I just wanted to play it because here's how the company itself sees the business that it's in.
Researchers need to identify treatment gaps to develop more targeted novel medicines. Hospitals must understand the total patient experience to improve the efficiency and quality of care. We deliver a comprehensive view of treatments, costs, and outcomes.
So, Adam Tanner, I mean, these are things that sound useful and could increase the quality of care overall for everybody in the healthcare system, for better research, better standards at hospitals. They're describing things that are good.
So data miners describe their business as being something that will help advance medicine, lead to new incredible breakthroughs in solving disease and coming up with new medication. So far, that's not happened. There's been interesting insights and cost analyses that have come from the studies, but no major breakthrough. And the way of traditionally researching medicine with two different groups taking different drugs, a placebo, and having a double-blinded study, these remain the standards that are bringing the breakthroughs. Ultimately, what I'm trying to do with this book, Our Bodies, Our Data, is encourage a discussion about what is the best approach to our medical data. What has happened is that commercial companies have decided for themselves, with very little public discussion, what's best to do with our medical data. Now, all over the United States and in places like Boston in particular and the environs, you have lots of great researchers who are doing very good work using data and other means to try to solve disease, gain new insights. A lot of people would gladly contribute to those efforts if they had control over their data. I think patients should have control of their data, both anonymized and named. And if you want to help science, and I think many people would, you would be able to donate to those programs. So I think we should encourage science to go forward, but I don't think we should let industry in and of itself decide what's best for everybody without telling them about it.
But let me ask you, Adam Tanner, I mean, look, personally, I am very sympathetic to any efforts to monitor the whittling away of our privacy. But I've yet to hear I wasn't quite sure I saw in your book any evidence of any harm having been done, especially from this anonymized data, even as it's bought and sold and used by different companies. Is there any evidence of harm having been done?
I think the greatest harm ultimately, as people realize that there is a big commercial trade in their data, is the confidence in the system itself. You might be less willing to tell your doctor everything and be fully candid about your problems if you knew that someone else was, in essence, listening in on that conversation. Imagine if you went to a priest or another religious official and you gave confession or told them intimate facts. That information anonymized would be fascinating for social scientists, as would true details from a tax accountant's office or from a criminal defense attorney's office. But the nature of that conversation, of that interaction, would change if you knew that that information was in commercial circulation. And I fear the same is ultimately true with our information. If we understand that it's being sold at every turn, it may undermine the confidence in the system. So I think that's the most important point. There are people who receive direct advertising. There are people who have been harmed from this. There could be people denied life insurance, people denied various benefits, discriminated against in various ways. Even since writing this book, various people who've worked for companies that gather data have called me to say that even though they're in the industry, they are concerned about these practices and think it will lead to discrimination, to workers being fired, and so on.
Yeah.
So there's certainly some real risks that exist with wide circulation of patient data for commercial purposes.
Now, some states have tried to change state law to account for the information that you've been talking about. I mean, New Hampshire was the first state, right, to take a stand against companies like IMS. They have something called the Prescription Information Confidentiality Act, passed back in 2006. What happened there?
So in many cases of this trade in patient-related data, people along the way have not known about it. So doctors for many years did not know that there was a commercial trade in their data that identified which prescriptions that they were writing. So when doctors caught wind of this, several states in New England passed legislation barring these commercial doctor-identified profiles. Companies such as IMS and other data miners fought back. The case went to the Supreme Court, and ultimately the court ruled that they had a First Amendment right to trade this data.
A First Amendment right to trade the data. Okay. And
but if you redefine what data is, if you said information about patients, whether it's identified or not identified, is protected by HIPAA or whatever successive laws we have, that would be a different story. You could protect certain kinds of intimate data. That's what I think we should have a discussion about.
I see. Now, you speak in the book, Our Bodies, Our Data, you speak with an activist, Deborah Peel. She's created a group called Patient Privacy Rights, and she argues that there's no chain of custody for health data. And what exactly does she mean by that? And would it even be possible to change that reality?
So again, if we go back to this example, you're talking to your doctor, you think only your doctor knows. You're talking to the pharmacist, you think only that person knows. But what happens is what you think would be a one-to-one transaction is actually going to many, many different people. There's research done at Harvard that shows a site, thedatamap.org. It shows you a cluster of many, many different sites of all the places the data goes, many more than you can expect. And often to places or entities that you think you have no association with. There was a big data breach from the health insurer Anthem a few years ago. Almost 80 million people lost information about them through this breach. I was one of those people, but I had no relationship with Anthem whatsoever. Doing some research, I realized that a former employer passed on that information to someone else who passed it on to Anthem, who was then hacked, and now my data would be in circulation. So this chain of custody of where your data comes from is quite interesting because it's in wide circulation in places you don't expect, and then it can be vulnerable to hacking or other kinds of misuse.
So it makes me wonder, is there anything that patients, individuals can do who don't want their information shared, whether or not it's anonymized? I mean, what you just said makes me think that it's impossible to keep your information from getting out there.
Well, there's a couple different issues. The security against hacking in the medical sphere is not as strong as it is in the financial sphere. So certainly from the doctor's level to the hospitals to big insurers, we need to see stronger levels of protection and security. For an individual concerned about the privacy of their information, you could choose insurers or doctors who do not use entities that share their data with commercial people. So, for example, Aetna does not share or does not sell claims forms. There are certain electronic health records that do not share claims forms. But it's very hard for an individual to pick and choose healthcare providers based upon who's sharing data or selling the data. I think a preferable way would be to empower patients to have control of their own records and then decide with whomever they want to share it. The other irony, of course, is that we would like to have full access to our own records for our own medical treatment, but that doesn't exist right now.
Right.
So if something happens to me here in Alaska, they don't have access to my Boston area medical records. So the stuff we want for our own care is not present, and the stuff we may not desire, the commercial circulation of a dossier about us, is in circulation.
Well, Adam Tanner is a writer in residence at the Institute for Quantitative Social Science at Harvard University. His new book is Our Bodies, Our Data, How Companies Make Billions Selling Our Medical Records. Adam Tanner, it's been very eye-opening speaking with you. Thank you so very much.
Thanks very much. I also have a website, adamtanner.news, and Data Curtain is the Twitter handle.
Thank you. We'll link to all of that at our website, radioboston.org. Let's turn now to the Remembrance Project. Writer Alyssa Eli's look at the extraordinary lives of people in our community. Today, Eli remembers a Connecticut man with several hobbies and one deep passion.
Paul Harris loved desserts so much, he thought about buying a Carvel ice cream franchise in Connecticut back when he was running a moving van company there. He loved bridge so much, he became a master-level player. But his greatest love, aside from his wife of 65 years and five children, was golf.
When I was a kid, when he got a hole-in-one, like, the whole golf club would come and, like, there'd be this big celebration, you know, because it's hard to do, especially on a championship golf course.
Sometimes Joy Harris played golf with her father. And in a bid for marital union, her mother learned to play, too. Even the house accommodated him.
When I was growing up in Connecticut, we had this bathroom that my mother decorated in golf motif. So, and it had all my father's trophies in there and all the plaques and everything, but everything in the bathroom was golf-oriented. So, like, the knobs on the sink were golf balls. And the towels were all, you know, golf, and the wallpaper was all golf. And I think the carpet was, like, green, like a, you know, like a green, like a golf green. And so people would come over and, you know, they'd go in that bathroom and they'd be in there for a long time.
After retirement, Paul and his wife moved to a golf community in Florida where he played 3 to 4 times a week. Age and cataracts made precision more difficult, but no less successful. Once in his mid-70s, he teed off with a friend. He knew the shot had landed, though neither of them could see where.
They start walking towards the hole looking for the ball. They couldn't find it. And then his friend said, you know, joking, maybe it's in the hole. And so they went over and it was.
Ball hawking was another passion, a way of scouring for treasure.
He had this outfit that he would wear that was just hysterical. It was sort of like some of his old army clothes, you know, like fatigues and everything. But then he'd have these big rubber boots and this machete, you know, in a golf club.
The machete was for alligators in the water hazards. Paul knew where they lived. Afterwards, he would sort his treasure by quality, clean them with care, and then send his friends egg cartons packed with golf balls. True love is hard to give up, but when he was around 80, Paul did.
One day he just said to me, I'm not going to play golf anymore. Do you want my clubs? But it was harder for me than it was for him. He was ready to move on.
Yet delight was deep in his character, and Paul wasn't finished with love. On a trip to Colorado, Joy and her husband took him up a mountaintop. He gazed at the panorama with old eyes that had become new. If only I'd known there were places like this, he told them, I wouldn't have played so much golf.
Writer Alyssa Eli remembering Paul Harris, who died in August. If you'd like to suggest a loved one for remembrance, email remember@wbur.org. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Finally today, let's talk about love and relationships, politics, and sex, because our next guest is the legendary Vice columnist Dan Savage. He's an author, LGBT activist, and co-founder of the It Gets Better Project. And here's a clip from the most recent episode of his podcast, where Dan helps a gay male listener confront a friend with benefits with a smell issue.
What are you risking here if you say something and he's offended? You're risking whatever sex you're having with him. But I think you should be the friend in Friend with Benefits. That part comes first. Sometimes friends say to friends, like, dude, you got to know that when you do X, blank, happens.
Well, Dan Savage will be performing a live taping of his podcast at the Wilbur Theater tonight, but he joins us now in the studio. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
It's so great to have you. And listeners, this is your chance. If you can't make it to the taping tonight, if you have a relationship or love question for Dan Savage, call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also send us a tweet at Radio Boston. So, Dan, for the few people out there who may not know your origin story, I'm always mindful of those folks.
I was bit by a radioactive sex advice spider in my childhood.
And a star was born. How'd you get into the advice business?
You know, you fall into it. I met somebody at a party who was moving to Seattle to start a newspaper. It was Tim Kak, who co-founded The Onion, which invented writing about baloney in the AP style. That was Tim. And he was telling me about his paper, and I looked at him and said, oh, you should have an advice column because everybody reads those. You see that format, you can't not read it. And he said, excellent advice, write the advice column. And I really wasn't angling for the gig. I'd never written anything for publication before in my life. And I was gay and very gay and still am very gay. And he was starting a straight newspaper. And how was that going to work? A gay guy giving sex advice to straight people in a straight newspaper. And that became the joke that sort of got it off the ground in the first year. Because the idea originally was I was going to treat straight people and straight questions with the same contempt and revulsion that heterosexual advice columnists had always treated gay people and gay sex questions with, and then give a little advice. And
you know, you never quite lost that contempt or revulsion.
Well, you know, straight people loved it. It was a new experience for them. They had never been treated this way, and it was sort of comic. And what had been originally thought of as, you know, something I would do for 6 months or a year as a joke and then hightail it back to Europe, where I'd been living with my then boyfriend, is now I'm 26 years into writing this sex advice, syndicated sex advice column.
26 years.
Yeah, and it runs in China in one paper, and it runs in Italy. It's crazy.
Do you get questions or letters or pleas for help from your international audience?
Yes, I do. And it's a little crazy. You know, where you are, location, location, location matters often, particularly when you're talking about sexual minorities or trans people. And so the advice that you might give to someone who's struggling with coming out in the United States is very different than the advice you would give to somebody who's struggling with coming out in Pakistan. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I'm reading a letter thinking, oh, this is what I would tell this person. And then I get to the end and they tell me that they're writing from the United Arab Emirates.
Right.
And that's very different at that moment, what you might say to that person.
Yeah, because their safety could be literally on the line.
Right.
Oh, wow.
And not just the safety of queer people is threatened in those parts of the world. Women are terrorized and threatened in those parts of the world for any expression of sexual agency. Opposite sex couples have been arrested for adultery or public displays of affection. So it's not just queer people that get it in the teeth. I think queer people get it in the teeth more often and worse, but still.
Well, so let's talk a little bit about how you grew up for a second, because you grew up in Chicago in a Catholic family. You were an altar boy as a child, and you describe yourself as a lapsed Catholic. Does anything about your upbringing or your Catholicism shape your world today? Does it creep into?
Oh, absolutely. I call myself now a cultural Catholic. I do identify as Catholic in the same way a lot of my Jewish friends who don't believe in God, aren't awaiting the Messiah, and eat plenty of bacon identify as Jews. It's my cultural heritage and my cultural tradition. You know, a lot of religious conservatives object to my existence and the existence of my column and my advice. But if you dump all of the advice I've ever given into a stock pot and boil it all down to its essence, what you're left with is the golden rule: do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Mm-hmm. It's just there's a lot more that can be done unto people in my universe than in some other people's worlds.
Yeah, we've got a couple tweets here.
Oh, awesome.
I just want to remind folks that that voice that you hear is that of Dan Savage. He's the Savage Love advice columnist and host of the Savage Lovecast podcast. He's going to be taping a live episode of the podcast at the Wilbur Theater tonight, and we've got information about that at radioboston.org. But he will answer your questions if you got them today. You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK for your chance to talk to Dan Savage. We got a tweet here from Sylvia Guerrera. She says, Dan, you don't know me, but you've helped me so much with coming out to my family. It really means so much to me.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you for that.
That's from Sylvia. And we also have another one here from Sunshine Boston. Okay, so it says, please comment on the strategy, that's capitalized, the strategy before sex, lest let's test together for a variety of STIs, then make an informed decision, question mark. So I'm not quite sure what Sunshine Boston's question is, but strategies for dealing with...
How to roll that out,
how to ask for it.
Well, if that's your requirement before you're intimate, you just put that on the table. And if they don't want to test, then you do not have sex with them. That is the price of admission that they have to pay. I like to talk about the price of admission a lot when I talk about relationship issues in Savage Love. That's the price of admission that you're going to charge to sleep with you. That might cost you some experiences, but they wouldn't be experiences that you would want to have if they came bundled with, to you, what might seem like unacceptable risks. Mm-hmm. It's not a perfect strategy. There are sexually transmitted infections that can be passed through skin-to-skin contact. There are some that, particularly in men, can't be tested for very accurately. So there's always risk. There's no such thing as a risk-free sexual encounter. And only when it comes to sex do we talk about risk-free as the standard. There's no such thing as a risk-free chicken salad sandwich. And yet people will go and eat chicken salad sandwiches knowing full well that other people have eaten a chicken salad sandwich, got salmonella, and died. Oh, yeah. And snowboarding and skiing, which are passions of mine, snowboarding, every day somebody dies on a mountain. And people don't say no one should ski. People say, well, do what you can to mitigate those risks. There's inherent built-in risk in this activity. And at a certain point, you have to shoulder those risks. And sex, when we talk about sex, we always talk about risk as if there's any risk at all, you should not be doing this. And that's just evidence of a sex-negative culture's double standards when it comes to sex.
Do you think that we've gotten better about talking about sex in the quarter century that you've been doing this?
I hope so. I think so, yes. And I would credit it really to two things, the LGBT civil rights movement and the HIV/AIDS epidemic, which moved in concert to a great degree after the 80s. But the LGBT civil rights movement really put it in straight people's heads that when you went to we saw pictures of a gay pride parade, if you looked at more than one, it wasn't just the go-go boys and the drag queens, you would see all these many different ways to be gay, because you would see the gay parents and the gay Christian groups and the lesbian dykes on bikes and, you know, the go-go boys and the drag queens and the leather guys and the married gays with kids. And straight people look at that and go, okay, there's so many ways to be gay. Is there really just one way to be straight? Uh-huh. Or can I be my own kind of straight? And can there be many ways to be straight? And the HIV/AIDS epidemic forced people to talk about the sex people were actually having and not the sex that we all agreed people ought to be having.
Right.
And that changed the conversation around sex.
Interesting. Well, we've got a call here. You can call 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK if you want your chance to talk to Dan Savage. He's going to be at the Wilbur Theater tonight, but he's with us at Radio Boston right now. Again, that's 800-423-8255. And let's go to Lee, who's calling from Cambridge. You're on the air, Lee.
Hi, Dan. So I'll be as quick as possible. I'm nervous. So I am a former dominatrix who has a friend who then became my pet. And our relationship evolved, and now he wants to dominate me, which I do want, but I'm scared. And I don't know why I'm scared, because when we talk about it, I do want to do it. But then when it comes time to do it, I panic.
Well, you have to trust your gut. And if there's something that doesn't feel right about it, whether it's submission in that context or submitting to him that leaves you feeling uncomfortable, you have to trust your gut and either find someone else to do it with or don't do it because maybe it's not right for you. Or, you know, it may make you feel more comfortable if you take the baby steps approach, which everyone should take when you're talking about varsity level kinks. Baby steps, baby steps, baby steps. If when you're discussing with him the scene you might want to engage in, and it's all the bells and whistles, and it's, you know, 100% of the BDSM sort of menu, that might be off, but because you don't know what his skills are as a dom. You know what he's like as a sub, but you don't know if you can trust him submitting. So baby steps. Don't go to 100 that first time. Go to 2 or 3 or 5 or 8 that first time, and maybe that'll make you feel a little bit more comfortable about doing it. But if you never get there, if you never feel comfortable about doing it, please don't do it.
Lee, does that help a bit?
Yes, that's kind of how I was feeling about it anyway, but I really want to. I don't know why. It's just when it's time to do it, I panic.
You know, there's sometimes when, you know, I'm going to contradict myself, which I'm famous for. There are sometimes when you got a bungee jump, like you're standing on that ledge with the bungee jump cord strapped to your ankles, and you regret paying the money to go bungee jumping, and you're not sure you want to do it, and sometimes you only realize you wanted to bungee jump after the bungee jump was over, and you were right to take that step, even though it was very scary at that moment, and your gut was telling you to back out. And then you jump, and you're happy that you jumped later. But, you know, some people take that step and bungee jump and the cord breaks and they die. So individual results may vary.
Oh, I was with you until the cord breaking part.
Well, it happens. And again, it's the double standard thing. You know, people don't say we should ban bungee jumping because there have been some deaths. People say, ah, there are risks with bungee jumping.
Yeah.
But when it comes to sex, people say, oh my God, you know, a bad thing. You could get split ends. A bad thing could happen. No one should ever do this sex thing ever. But we don't say that about anything else.
Well, Dan, let's talk about you again for a second here, because I did want to recall a moment. Back in 2009, I think, you told a story on This American Life about your mother, because you were talking about her and how she came around to supporting you when you came out to her. I mean, that's obviously such a huge moment in any individual's life. Can you just tell us that story again? What happened?
Well, I came out 35 or 6 years ago, 37 years ago, a long time ago. And my parents were Catholic. My father was a Catholic deacon. My mom was a Catholic lay minister. And I was an altar boy. I also went to a seminary for high school, and I was going to be a priest. For about 5 minutes, I thought about it. And then I realized I could wear dresses and live in a big house full of stained glass and Catholic kitsch without getting ordained, and opted for the latter. And when I told my mom I was gay, you know, she had problems with that. We had a couple of knockdown, drag-out fights about it because it meant I could never marry. It meant I could never have children, and that was very important to her. And I looked at her and said, and whose fault is that? Mm-hmm. Who decided that we can't get married? Who decided we can't parent? It wasn't us. It was you. You guys. Straight people. Lumping my mother in with all the evil straight people in the world, which she resented very much. But it didn't take her long to come around. And what brought her around, and I always cite this when people accuse me, as Brian Brown of the National Organization for Marriage has accused me, of being anti-Catholic. And what really helped my mother, and this, I am so eternally grateful to this priest for this, is my mom called a priest who came to our house to tell him, to ask for counseling, because I had come out to her as gay. And my mom sat down on the front porch with Father Tom, whose last name I never use because I don't want to get him in trouble, with Father Tom, and said, Danny says he's gay. Not Danny is gay. Danny says he's gay.
Yeah.
And she said that to Tom, and Tom put his hand on my mother's knee and said, Judy, I'm gay. And that really helped my mother in that moment, because she had been there for Tom. He'd had a drinking problem. He'd had to go to priest rehab for drinking. There are worse things that priests get sent to rehab for, as we all are aware of now, thanks in part to the Boston Globe. And she knew that he had struggled so mightily with shame and guilt, and now knew why. And he said to my mother in that moment, it's better that he live as an openly gay person than to live the life I've lived.
Is this still a hard story for you to tell?
Yeah, I get a little weepy every time I tell it. I'm so eternally grateful to Father Tom, because in that moment, he made it possible for my mother and I to keep talking. Like, everything wasn't perfect after that, but it really opened my mother's heart, and it really helped us. And it wasn't long before, you know, my mother was the matriarch and the boss of all of her younger siblings. She was the oldest. Our house was the house, the Christmas house, the Thanksgiving house. And it wasn't long before my mother let everybody know. You know, I'm talking about coming out to my family in 1979, 1980, 1981, before she let everyone know that if anyone had a problem with me, as I said in that piece for This American Life, which I wrote about her passing, that if they had a problem with me, they had a much bigger problem with her.
Yeah. So that keep talking part, is that kind of what you do with the column and the podcast?
You know, yeah, you keep talking. You talk about these
things.
That's
what, like that's what you're getting people to do, to keep talking, right? To not shut down, you know, whatever scary questions they might not feel like they could ask anywhere else.
And you have to keep talking about sex because you're in constant negotiation with sex. Sex is more powerful than we are. Sex is in charge. We like to pretend that sex is something that we make decisions about, and really it's the other way around. Sex through natural selection and spontaneous mutation, it built us. It created us. We are a product of sex. Sex isn't ours, and sex is at work right now building whatever comes after us. And the idea that we dictate terms to our sexuality as opposed to the other way around is just crazy. We are constantly negotiating our surrender, the terms of our surrender. And we have to be smart about it. And we can't just do whatever it is that we feel, because emotions and other people's safety and bodies have to be taken into consideration, of course, but we have to flow with it and go with it. Yeah. And fighting it just fills you with shame and conflict, and then you will burst out in an inappropriate way. It wins in the end. And you see that with, you know, famous closet cases like Ted Haggard. sex wins in the end.
Yeah. Well, you know, speaking of powerful forces, we didn't even talk about politics, but quite frankly, I'm glad to take a break from it. So.
I talk a lot about politics on my show
and
in my column, and people sometimes give me grief and say, why don't you stick to sex? And I always say, when politicians stick to politics and leave sex alone, I will stick to sex and leave politicians and politics alone.
Nailed it. Well, Dan Savage, he is the Savage Love Advice columnist and host of the Savage Lovecast podcast. He will be taping a live episode of his podcast at the Wilbur Theater tonight. There's a lot of information about that at radioboston.org. Dan, thank you so much for coming in today. It was such a delight to talk with you.
Thanks for having me. And you can read my weekly column here in The Dig.
Oh, as well. That's right. Again, we're going to have links to all of that at radioboston.org. That's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.